backwards. I didn't find out that till I got to the wall about the one in the back, you know. I stopped for a piece of it and I never felt him. You feel it afterwards, mind you. But just at the moment, you didn't feel anything at all.
Now, after you were wounded, what sort of treatment did you get in France?
Well, first of all, the two officers took me to an advanced field post, a dressing station, in Bernafay Wood.
Yeah?
And I was sort of re-bandaged there, you see. And while we were there, there was a man brought in on a... the time down with a wire on a stretcher, got shell shock. God, he was raving mad. But then, when it got dark, from there, I was put into a horse ambulance. A pair of horses, sort of a covered wagon sort of thing it was, with two stretchers at the bottom and two stretchers at the top. And I was in one of the upper stretchers. And from that point, we had to cross what had been no man's land for 22 months. Well, the road was in a hell of a state, and this thing was lurching all over the place, and before long, myself and the other lad on the top stretcher, we were thrown into the floor. There was nothing we could do about it. There was only one chap, nobody inside, only the driver up front. He got us to Billon Wood. And from there, we were unloaded and put onto a motor ambulance, and it was a Siddeley Deasy. I remember that, with the radiator where the Renaults used to be, just in front of the dash, behind the bonnet. And there was no room inside, so I was put on the front with a blanket around me, and the driver was told to hold on to me so I didn't fall out. From that point, we were taken down to, this is still during the night, we were taken down to Dives Copse. And that was a big marquee. And we were just laid on the grass there, not even on stretchers, just laid on the bare grass. And they gave us an injection for tetanus, I think, in the chest. And then we left to nobody at all. Well, I wanted to piss like hell. And so I crawled out of there on my elbow and my knees, and I laid on my side. I had to pee in the grass outside and crawled back again. Well, in the morning, some of the old Tin Lizzie ambulances came, the ancient T-model Fords, with 3.5-inch rear tyres and 3-inch fronts, and transverse springs, which were useless. That took us down to Corby, and we were taken to a school there, and laid on the bare boards. Nobody came near us. This was in the, I think, maybe 10 o'clock in the morning we got there, and nobody came near us all day. Nothing was done whatever. I had some secret codes with, you know, that... I crawled to the fireplace and... You know, that... I crawled to the fireplace and put a match to those and burnt them. And then in the evening, we were taken to the station and loaded onto a train for Rouen. And that was the first time we saw any nurses. All this guff about nurses in the battle front, I mean, that was just rubbish. We got to Rouen and... The first thing was we were undressed, and I felt rather embarrassed with this girl undressing me. She used the towel, you know, discreetly, and as she's pulling my shirt up at the back, there was a sudden sharp stab of pain, and I just said sort of ouch like that, you know, and she said, what's the matter? So I said, she was smoking a cigarette, and I said, I've dropped some atoms. She said, I haven't. And when she pulled my shirt up, she said, there was another wound in the back. I said, there was a piece of shell there, a shell splinter. And she said, oh, here's the culprit, and she threw it in the grass. So, bang went my souvenir, and however, Dr. McNeil was the man's name, who came round and examined us, and he said to me, no need to worry, laddie, I thought I got lockjaw, because my jaw by then was locked up tight, and he says, you've not got lockjaw. I says, you've got a piece of dirty German iron wedged in the hinges.
In the hinges of your jaw?
Yes, that's what he said. So in the morning, we were unloading, putting onto buses, the old London buses, and taken down to the quayside in Rouen, and put aboard the St. Andrew, which was...
Who were the drivers of the buses? Civilians or military?
Oh, no, military. Yeah. Military.
Before we go over to England on the boat, could you tell me a bit more about the dressing station that you went to, first of all? Where was it set up, and how big was it?
At Bernafay Wood?
Yeah.
Well, it was only... sort of dug into a bunk, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Describe what you can remember about it.
Nothing much, because they evacuated them as quickly as they could. You see, they only went in there to have the dressings put on, that's all. There was nobody stayed there. Mm. the ambulances kept were coming up and taking them away.
Yeah.
They were merely to sort of give a man, I suppose, a preliminary dressing to stop bleeding and that sort of thing. Mm. They didn't give you any actual treatment.
Yeah.
Not as far as I could see.
And the other places you went to in France, you mentioned the school and you mentioned Rouen. Mm. Were either of these major hospitals?
No. The school was nothing, just there's no nurses, nobody there at all.
Mm.
It was just a place to store you until they could move you on.
What about Rouen? Was that set up for...
Well, that was a hospital, yes.
Yeah.
Mm. In Marquise.
Yes. Mm. Can you remember much about that hospital? How big it was?
I was only there one night in the morning, that's all. Yeah. No, I was in the Marquise all the time, I've no idea. No. Mm.
There were military...
It was a Scottish, second Scottish something hospital, I believe. And now this doctor who attended me, his name was Captain McNeil. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah. After Rouen, they loaded you on a boat.
We got on the St. Andrew. It was a beautiful sunny day. And we were all sat about, of course the bad cases they were taken down below, you see. And there was a colonel, RMC, came up and you had a tag on your tunic, you see. And he looked at this tag and he yelled for one of the NCOs, had me bunged down below quick. I didn't want to go down, I wanted to step on deck. But went down below onto, I suppose, presumably to be the saloon deck. And the starboard side was... they're made of bunks, three tiers, one at floor level, you see, one halfway and one just below the upper deck, you see. And I was in the top one, and on the port side there were tables with a coaming, it's like a ledge around the edge, you know, so that the plates and things didn't fall off. We went down the river, and by dinner time we were out into the channel, you see. And through the porthole, which was open, I saw one of those five-masted Scandinavian full-rig ships, you know. And heeling over, I said, and in the sun, it was one of the most wonderful sights I've ever seen in my life. Mm. And I said, she was really moving, too. So the ship was just rolling gently, you know, like that, you know. And they started bringing the usual stew for the chaps, you see. There were seven men on either side of this table and one man at the head serving, you see. They passed the plates down either side and I could see this ship rolling more and more as we got further out into the channel until I could see the wave as she dipped. I could, from my position in the top, I could see the wave just a few inches below the porthole, and I was just going to shout and warn them, and the next wave came clean through that porthole, a solid jet of water, and dropped plonk onto that table, and the plates just went like that, upended and deposited the stew in the laps of each man, you see. So the man at the head of the table, brave man, jumped on the table to shut the porthole.
Yeah.
Just in time to catch the next one solidly in the chest, which knocked him backwards clean off the end of the table into the floor. Then one of the crew came up and got it at it from the side and shut it, you see. All went well after that. But I thought it was rather amusing at the time, although the fellows who suffered didn't. They were all wet through. Mm. And so we got to England eventually, and at Southampton, we were loaded into on a train, and we walking cases were put into ordinary corridor coaches, and each compartment had been filled up with sort of straw and mattresses and things, so that we could lay right across the seats, four men in each compartment. And there were girls coming in down the corridor changing our French money into English money. Those who hadn't changed on board the ship, but aboard the ship we wouldn't do it because they were only giving you about sevenpence for a franc, you know. And they were making money very, very nicely, the RAMC. So, however, we got to Birmingham eventually, to New Street, and we had to change engines there, I think. And while we stood in this platform, because there was a huge crowd on the waiting to see them.
At Birmingham,
yes. Mm. This was the first successful offensive, you see. And there were hundreds of people on the platform, and one of the chaps in my compartment, a chap called Bill Nees, as I found out later.
When you got to Birmingham, were the civilians much in evidence?
Very much. The platform was crowded with people, and we were up at in the corridor by then, you see, and there was this one of these chaps, Bill Neat, he had a German helmet. I had one, but because not being able to get back to my battery, I'd lost mine and everything, you see. But he was showing this, and they started to bid him for it. And eventually the bids got up to £4.10, which is an awful lot of money in 1916. And then the train suddenly began to move and we were off. And I remember several times afterwards, when we were in hospital, Bill used to say, we were broke. I wish I'd sold that bloody hell, but we had a chance.
Tell me, why was there such a big crowd at Birmingham, do you think?
They knew the train was coming. Knew the train was coming. Oh, yes, they must have done. And now, we got off from there and we arrived at Manchester.
But at Birmingham, you were saying that there was some excitement amongst the people who were waiting.
Well, everybody was congratulating us, you know, and giving us gifts and such as that, you know. And there was no warning. The train suddenly moved off.
What were they congratulating you about?
What were you supposed to have won on the sum?
Can you remember the kind of impression they created?
Well, they seemed to
the kind of things they said?
They seemed to think that because we'd made an advance, we were well on the way towards winning the war. But, to our mind, I thought they were rather optimistic, to say the least.
Did you disillusion any of them?
No, not really. I don't remember all that was said at the time, but I remember when we arrived at Manchester.
Well, why do you think that they thought the Somme operation was such a success?
Well, I should say that the newspapers had cracked it up as being an advance, and therefore they thought it was a success. They didn't think about the cost of it, a lot of them.
Mm.
You don't know what was in these people's mind. I mean, we were in France at the time when they got the news, so we just don't know what they thought.
But were there any particular kinds of indicators that they thought the Somme was a success? I mean, they have sort of banners welcoming you home and things like that?
Oh, some of the children had flags and that sort of thing, you know. But mostly it was just, I think, the novelty of it. There was a huge batch of wounded coming through, you see, because the hospitals in France just couldn't cope with them, and men who were only lightly wounded were being shoved over to England. When you remember that we had 60,000 casualties within 59,000 some hundreds, on the first day alone, that the hospitals in France were simply overwhelmed. They just couldn't, didn't know where to put them. That's why we were dumped in these schools and things, didn't know where to put the men. So, get rid. There were some fellows who got to hospital with me. They were only in hospital 3 or 4 weeks, and then they were discharged. Just slight wounds, you know.
So after Birmingham, you moved on?
We got to Manchester then. When we came out of the station there, you never saw anything like it. The crowd was such that they had mounted police to hold them back. And some of the serious cases, they were loaded into ambulances. We were loaded into cars, civilian cars, all the walking cases. I was in a 1216 Sunbeam, a gentleman and his son in front. There was myself. It was open car, you know, the open tour, as they called them in those days. And the rear part was all filled up with sacks of straw, something like that, and we were laid across there, absolutely out in the open. And as we drove through Manchester at a walking pace, the cars were just being mobbed. The chap who was with me, he was only very small. I learned after that he was a jockey, but he was 27 years old and he had 2 or 3 kids, and I thought he was a drummer boy, or a little fellow like him. He'd getting all the attention, but you could gauge the hysteria when I tell you that they were giving us such things as balaclava helmets in the middle of July, going into hospital. Cigarettes, sweets and things, enough to stock a shop, but balaclava helmets, I ask you, I mean, all the stupid things, but they felt that they'd got to give you something. That was what was behind it. And that crowd lasted all the way to Rochdale, 13 miles. The route was lined all the way to Rochdale. When we got to Rochdale, there were more people there waiting to receive us than there were patients. And there were 690 men went into that hospital that day. It only had accommodation for 200. It was a workhouse infirmary on Smithy Bridge Road in hospital, in Rochdale.
During this trip to Rochdale, can you tell me any more about the crowd reactions?
Only that they were, every time you slowed down, they were chucking things in the car at you. Even the only packets of cigarettes. Mm. They wanted to give you something to show their appreciation, I presume. And when we got to Rochdale, we were unloaded into this place, and I was bathed by two men who I found out were weavers, in the cotton industry. And they were gentle with me as a woman could have been. And I was way there, and I weighed only something over 9 stone. And I was 11 stone odd when I was hit. I'd lost 2.5 stone. Because, you see, when the jaw been locked up, I had nothing to eat. I'd only had a few drinks. I haven't had anything to eat at all. I'd lost blood and I'd lost weight as well. I had nothing to eat. That was in 6 days from being hit. It was July 23rd when we got to Rochdale.
And at Rochdale, you were in the Birch Hill Workhouse, which had been converted.
That's right.
Been converted to a hospital.
No, only the hospital itself. The workhouse still functioned normally.
Oh, I see.
It's just the workhouse hospital which was taken over. And to accommodate all the overflow, there were all these marquees outside. And how they managed that, they didn't know until Sunday morning that this train load of wounded was coming. And the hospital Hayworth, he sent out with some of the other old workhouse inmates, you know, to all the places of worship in Rochdale, notices asking for helpers up at the infirmary that evening because they expected a batch of wounded, damaged. All Rochdale had come nearly. And the final straw was girls who were coming round with a big form filling in the details, and the bottom was next of kin, just in case, you see. And there was one girl who found out she was the daughter of the local postmaster at the bottom of the road, which the hospital was up to, you see. And for a long while after, we called her Miss Next of Kin before we knew her properly.
Were the conditions in the hospital quite good?
Oh, yes. I had the time of my life there. I mean, it was a civilian hospital, and the military, it was under the Second Western General at Manchester. Colonel Westmacott was in charge there, and a Captain Wright, I think his name was, used to come once a month, and sometimes the Colonel came. That's all we saw of the control. Otherwise, the Dr. Coker was the resident doctor there, and there was a Dr. Wright and Dr. Scar and his son as well. He was only 26 and we had a dust up with him, one of the Irishmen. When we were convalescents, we used to go down to the town of an evening. We're not supposed to do it, so we were supposed to be in at four, but the nurses winked. They never said a word when he came in late. Just a naughty boy, you know, something like that, get into bed. And so, we used to come in through a back entrance. There was a tall iron rail fence, you see, and we'd sprained a couple of the bars so that they bent wide enough to get through. But if you turned them at an angle, from a distance, they didn't look to be bent at all. You used to turn these two bars, we could squeeze through. Well, evidently, Dr. Scar had got to know about this. And so one night he was waiting for us, there was four of us coming back. And one of these chaps was an Irishman, he was in the Munster Fusiliers, who only remembered us, Paddy, that's all. And Scar said something about, you know, where did we have been and all that, you see. And Paddy started on him, you know, a big fine man like you, etc., you ought to be in the army, etc., etc. And he was talking all the time, he never gave Scar to get a word in edgeways. And we were all the time saddling further on, we disappeared, and we never heard any more about it.
On these expeditions into town, you must have come into a good deal of contact with the civilians. Did you get any particular impressions about the extent of their knowledge of what was going on in the war?
Not particularly. They were more inclined to be hospitable to you than anything else. For instance, we used to go on a Tuesday afternoon to a matinee at the Hippodrome. Free matinee, the Hippodrome in Rochdale. There was two music halls, the Hippodrome and the Empire, and they combined the artists to give a matinee on the Tuesday afternoon with probably one or two local artists. There was a Harry Wiley, I think his name was, Harry Wiley, a ventriloquist or an elocutionist, rather, not ventriloquist, elocutionist. He used to be there sometimes, local man. And as you're coming home, if you walked any distance, there'd be these women on the doorstep on this road. What the devil is the road now?
That doesn't matter.
No. They'd invite you, will you stop and drop in and have a cup of tea? My boss will be in a few minutes. That was her husband. They'll refer to him as their boss, you see. And in the schools, the children refer to the headmaster as the boss. inviting him in like that. If you went home on the tram, went back on the tram, you'd find that some of these factory girls had paid you fare. The conductor, we were travelling at half fare, you see, in any case. But these factory girls would give the conductor your fare. There was a Jew used to come up to the hospital. It's something to do with the Board of Governors. I've forgotten his name. And he used to be going back about maybe 2 o'clock when we were going uptown. And these were double-decker trams, bogey trams, you know, would carry about 60 or 70 people. He'd pay for every one of us on the car.
Did these civilians then show no curiosity to learn from you about the war?
Not that I remember. No. We used to get visitors up there at the hospital at times, you know, to a few relatives I know. But there was one, I remember, 2 or 3 weeks after I'd got in, because I was still all bandaged up, you know. And this lady came, and she's very solicitous. She must have mistaken me for something like that, I don't know. She said, how is my wife and children? I was astounded. I was 21, 3 weeks after I got to hospital. Five days after I got to hospital. And so she was rather surprised. She thought I was over 30. But, you know, I think, looking back, that you aged more at that time. Shall I put it this way? You age several years in a few days.
I can understand that.
See? Whether it was in the lines of your face or what, I wouldn't know. But people, from that point onwards, people took me to be older than my years at the time.
Now, the hospital you were in here at Rochester, was that organised as a military hospital or was it a civilian hospital?
It was a civilian hospital controlled by the military from Manchester. But as I say, we only saw any military once a month. And they were so well treated there that in the early part of December, the resident doctor, Dr. Coker, was asking chaps who were ready to be discharged, did they want to stay another week or two over Christmas? And you'd be surprised how many of them stayed over Christmas there. And a number of them, who'd been discharged the week before Christmas, came back to the hospital for Christmas dinner during their leave.
Now, you yourself moved on from Rochester to...
I went on to Manchester.
Yes, which hospital was that you were in?
Ducie Avenue. It was a school. That was a school, technical, but very, very military. Very, very military, yes.
How did it differ from the Rochester hospital?
It was appalling.
Tell me about it.
I arrived there. I went for specialist treatment on my jaw, you see. And I arrived there. And I went into, it's all lit by gas, not even incandescent, the old bat's wing burners. Bloody awful place it was. And there was 11 men in this ward, I remember, and I arrived just before tea, and they brought in 2 tins of sardines for tea, amongst 11 of us. So I objected to that, and they said, well, that's all I get. I said, well, I'll go and do something about it. So I went to find one of these sisters. Now, there were 3 of them, and no one could decide who was senior. They all thought they were, and they were all the time, the 3 of them, giving orders, and then the other one countermanding them, you see. And the VAD nurses didn't know where they stood. One of these, the girl who was in this ward, she was in tears over this business. But I went to this woman, and I told her that these weren't sufficient rations, you see. That was a ration, that's all we would get. She says, oh, well, I'm going to the governor then, you see. Well, she gave me 4 more tins of sardines. Somebody had been doing very nicely out of those rations, I reckon. But however, next day...
Tell me more about the organisation of the hospital, how it differed from the Rochdale Hospital.
Well, we were having treatment. I was having treatment there. They were squirting something out of a syringe in my jaw. What good did I don't know. I was x-rayed again there. I was x-rayed at the hospital at Rochdale every fortnight. They had their own x-ray, you see. And this piece of shell, which was it was lodged in the bone in my jaw, and as the bone knitted together, it gradually forced it out, but on the inside, and it's still there, matter of fact. And they decided that the only way to remove it was by an operation from behind the bone, you see. And the sister on the hospital, she said to me, don't let them do it, Leonard. She says, they'll be very, very close to the jugular vein if they do that. And, she said, and if they cut the facial nerve, she said, your face will be pulled up on one side and nothing else they can do about it. She said, if it's safe where it is, she says, don't you let them do it. And so I wouldn't have it.
You said the hospital was run on strict military lines.
At Ducie Avenue, yes.
What did that mean? I'm still interested in how it differed from Rochdale.
Well, in the first place, we had to be in at 4 o'clock.
In the afternoon?
Yes. I didn't know that. You had to hand in your greatcoat, and you had to sign for it when you went out. I didn't know that. I marched out the next day to have a look at Manchester with my coat on. Didn't come back until 5 o'clock. Played bloody hell. Because I hadn't given my coat in because I was an hour late, etc., etc. I'm on a charge. I'm up before this doctor in the morning about something. And then the next day, this girl was in tears. And so I rounded on this one of these sisters, you know. I said, she's just been told by Sister so-and-so what to do with me, you see. I said, now you're telling her different. I said, what's she supposed to do about it, you know? I'm booked for that, for insubordination. So on the Saturday morning, I have three charges already in 4 days. And so I went up to this doctor on this charge again, you see. And he looked at me, and I said, what am I to do with you? I said, I'll have my discharge, sir. So I said, but you've only just arrived. I said, I don't care. I said, I'm fed up with this place. I said, I want to be out of it. And he said, well, I wasn't fit to go back to my unit. All right, so eventually, I said, he compromised and he said, I could go to the command depot at Ripon.
Mm.
And I got my discharge papers and my railway warrant.
Mm. Before we go on to Ripon, it sounds from your description of the hospital that they were more concerned with strict adherence to military regulations than they were concerned about the treatment of the patients. But are there any other examples of those sort of military style in which the hospital was run that you can think of? I mean, was there a regular...
Oh, I was there 4 days.
Yeah.
Mm.
When you went into... But when you went into... Yeah?
I met the sisters. I came out the doctor's room, you see. And she looked sort of satisfied, smirked out. That sort of put him in his place, you see.
When
I had my dinner, then I got my kit, you see, and I'm marching up. I met her again. She said, where are you going? I said, I'm going home. She said, you're not, etc. I got my wand and I got my discharge. I said, I'm going. Good luck to you. Mm. I cleared off.
When you went into Manchester on your trips from this hospital, did you get any more insight in Manchester into the sort of civilian morale and civilian attitude to the war?
No. I didn't know anybody at all. I just had a walk around the place, that's all. And I don't remember anything of those 2 days in Manchester. I couldn't even tell you what I saw.
Okay.
All I wanted to do was get away from that place, you see.
When you got home to Hull on sick leave, what was your reception by your friends and your family?
Everybody was glad to see, you know, they sort of returned hero worship and all that sort of thing. I had to go around to all my relatives and such as that, you know. And I went into a tool shop in Hull Caves. I wanted some pliers because the pliers that were issued by the army were literally useless for cutting wire under shellfire. Or any circumstances. If you had to be sawing at the blooming wire to cut it, you're wasting time. There was no side cutters on them, just, you know, straight jaw pliers.
Mm.
And I decided I went to buy these pliers, and the shop was staffed mostly with girls by then, and the window displays were in sort of separate sections with an opening from behind, which was always locked. Small tools. These pliers were in the window and they were marked 2 shillings and 9p, which is a good price in those days. But I thought I'd have them. They were blued steel, the blue's worn off. And one of the girls, I was in hospital blues, you see, said, well, those are the only ones they had, but she said, I'll get them for you. So she got them out. I thought, well, I'm not going to let the army claim these. I'll get my initials put on them. So I went down the side street to the saw shop where John Ringer was, one of the bosses, was there. And I knew him. I asked him, could he put my initials on these? He just tossed them up and down. He said, where do you get these from? So I said, I've just bought them. He says, we haven't done this since the war started. He says, these are German. So I said, well, I don't care. I said, they'll do me. He said, I'll say they will. He said, you can't buy any like this in this country.
Mm.
And so he put them in a vice, and I held the punch while he used a big heavy hammer to get punch me, because he said, they're so hard.
Mm.
And those will still cut wire today.
Mm.
There's just a little bit of a gap, but you can see through there.
While you were at home in Hull, did your friends and your family talk to you much about what was going on in France?
Oh, yes.
Yeah? What kinds of things interested them?
Well, they were more inclined to be on the personal angle, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't much interested in the progress of the war, just on how I'd been faring, that sort of thing, you see. Mm-hmm.
Did they seem to you to know very much about the war, what was going on in France?
Well, not particularly. I mean, they don't have the same point of view at home as you have in France, you see. Apart from anything else, they've got possibly a wider view, if less intense. You in France, you've only got a local view, but more intense of your own particular section of the front for, say, 2 or 3 miles either side. But, for instance, we down on the Somme, we didn't know much about what was going up in, going on up in Belgium, anything like that. You see, we didn't care. For we had enough of problems of our own without thinking about other people's.
Mm. Did you find that the interest of your friends and family, or did you find in talking to them about the war that they had that their knowledge of it was inaccurate in any way?
No, they took their views from the paper mostly, you see, and to some extent from their own relatives, but you couldn't write much unless you see, because they're all censored.
Mm.
You're not allowed to send anything which might be of any value to the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So, pretty general knowledge, I suppose. It wasn't.
So after you finished your home leave, you went to the...
North Camp.
North Camp, and this was the Royal Artillery Command Depot.
Yes.
You said there that this was an awful place.
I did, yeah.
And that you volunteered to rejoin the battery because it was so bad. Well, what was wrong with it?
Well, it took me 5.5 hours from Hull. I left Hull about 5 o'clock and I got there about 10:30. And the